Hello, and welcome to Tin Talks. I'm your host, Jesse Turner. After being an Ayers College Access Counselor for 7 years in a rural high school, I wanted to talk to rural leaders about their story, who they are, why they do what they do now, and how they feel like they can help.
I was born here and raised here, and I'll make my grave here, it's home. Tennessee.
Today, we have the pleasure of talking to one of the most accomplished nonprofit leaders and philanthropists in our state, Ayers Foundation Trust President, and my friend Janet Ayers. Janet works tirelessly to improve the quality of life of rural Tennesseans. She served as the president of the Ayers Foundation Trust since 2007. Under her leadership, the nationally recognized Ayers Scholars Program has expanded to 33 high schools across 21 of Tennessee's most at-risk and distressed counties. The Ayers Scholars Program has served nearly 20,000 rural students by helping them remove any barriers they face in accessing a quality education and earning a degree or credential. And Janet, thank you for being our very first podcast guest.
Thank you for letting me be in the pioneer of this inaugural podcast.
Well, and what I paused for just a moment there, because this says born and raised in Unicoi County, and I recently heard that's not true.
That is not true.
That's not true. So tell me, born and raised where?
I was born in Kingsport, Tennessee.
Okay.
We moved all around because my dad, undergraduate degree was animal husbandry. His master's degree is in agriculture from UT.
Okay.
So from the age of 1 to 3, we lived on the Maryville farm in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Okay. Okay.
We moved to Alabama when I was 3, where he went to Auburn to veterinary school. And then we did his residency in Arcadia, Florida, when I was 7. But at the age of 8, we moved to Upper East Tennessee, Jonesboro.
Okay.
And so it's almost like I was a military kid for the first 8 years of my life, because we moved everywhere because of my dad's education.
Mm-hmm.
But from 8 on until I graduated from college, I was in Jonesboro, Tennessee, but moved to Unicoi County when I was probably in my mid-20s to operate a nursing home there.
Very nice. And that's where you made home.
That's where I made home. And the beautiful thing about it is, lots of times people talk about a rural community. If you weren't born and raised there, mm-hmm. you're always kind of, quote, an outsider. Unicoi County has always been good to me, to the point that somehow in all this translation, they have claimed me
as
their own. And I think that's an accomplishment in a rural community.
I think so, too.
I'm going to own that badge with honor.
Absolutely. Was Tennessee always was always the landing spot to come back to? Like, did your parents know after the education was done, once everything finished back up, that that was the goal to come back to East Tennessee?
Well, my parents are from Southwest Virginia, which is right over the line from East Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
So Jonesboro, Johnson City are really close to Gate City and Blackwater and Pennington Gap. They're just right. I mean, your health care was in Tennessee. If you were in Southwest Virginia, you went to Kingsport for your health care needs.
Gotcha, gotcha.
So I would say Southwest Virginia, East Tennessee has always been our roots.
Right.
But Tennessee became home for all of us when I was 8.
Okay.
And has been really good to my family.
So starting there, starting at 8, and you said from 8 until after college, tell us about those early years and how they impacted you. Like, you know, education was obviously important to your family. Your dad, numerous moves and sacrifices to make sure that his education was completed. Tell me about that early years of how seeing your dad in that role, how that impacted you and your education journey.
It was just one of those things. I don't really know anyone in my family. I'm unique from that rural space that doesn't have a college degree. So my mom is a retired school teacher. My grandmother had a degree in home economics. My great aunt had a master's degree in social work. You know, everybody in my family was very college-oriented, not just from the academic side, but socially, what it meant to be able to have that safety net, to go off to college, to learn. I remember my grandmother and my great aunt making sure on my 18th birthday, they took me to register to vote. So being community involved, civically engaged, higher education is just part of the DNA I grew up with. Not all students get that,
mm-hmm.
but I learned through my friends, who a lot were first generation, that it was game changing for those families that continued their education. While it was always baked into who I was as a person, equally it was baked in to making sure that those around us were informed and were going off to college. I remember my best friend in high school, it's when Chick-fil-A was new, and they gave college scholarships. She worked at the Chick-fil-A in the mall, and it was through Pell Grants and that Chick-fil-A scholarship, was able to go to school. So I watched firsthand how transformative this was to the people that I was the closest to.
So even then, it wasn't a secret to you. It was something to tell everyone about, to say, hey, this can boost you, this can help you improve that quality of life moving forward. Well, that's evident, too, of how you've been since then.
It was. And I think part of that was my mom being a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it was my dad realizing that a degree in animal husbandry probably wasn't going to open doors that, quite honestly, at that point in time, if he had chosen a track like welding or some other occupation, probably would have given him more instant mm-hmm. Return and income for our family. But I watched my mom be a school teacher while my dad was in college at veterinary school.
And then in your own college experience, so after high school, you studied healthcare administration at East Tennessee State University. And was that an easy decision for you to make? Were you dead set on that from the beginning?
No.
No. Okay.
I wondered if there was a girl backstory yes. to healthcare administration.
Please tell me how you find that, because I don't think 10-year-old girls are walking around being like, I cannot wait to get my education in healthcare administration.
Absolutely not. Because I'm 60 years old. Healthcare administration, when I was 10 years old, wasn't even really a thing.
On the cusp of it. Okay.
Yes. So I grew up in a family of teachers, lawyers, doctors, veterinarians, architects, you know, those professions that you kind of knew. This mm-hmm. is college. This is what you do. I started out in pre-med.
Okay.
I was going to go to medical school, but simultaneously I was on the gymnastics team, and I ended up cheering at ETSU. Pre-med and extracurricular did not go well together. I chose extracurricular over pre-med. So Dr. Tom, about my junior year, through my mom, because my parents are very old-fashioned couple, my dad would say, you need to tell the girls this, mm-hmm. fill in the blank. My mom would be the messenger. So the message was, Janet, your dad says that you're going to have to choose a major, mm-hmm. or he's not going to continue to pay for you to play in college. So I went through my catalog mm-hmm. at ETSU. For whatever reason, my minor was in business. So I was pre-med and minoring in business. So I'd had a lot of healthcare classes, and there was a brand new degree, healthcare administration. So I'm looking through my catalog, trying to match up all the little hodgepodge of things I'd already done, and I landed on healthcare administration. I won't completely quote what my dad said, but I will paraphrase. Ah, Ellen. There were some explicitives in there. That's my mom's name. She might as well have chosen a degree in drama.
Oh my goodness.
What in the world are you going to do with a degree in healthcare administration? Pregnancy test at the health department, I guess.
Okay.
That is how pioneering and new healthcare administration was. So interesting, I am the oldest. So my middle sister went on to be an architect. My parents could understand that.
Mm-hmm.
My youngest sister is a physician. Healthcare administration sounded so out there that, you know, I guess my younger sisters were going to have to carry me through my golden years. It ended up being such a cutting-edge profession that it opened my door to so many things that I had no idea.
I'd love to hear that part, too, which is it's cutting edge. You're getting an education in it. How do you make that leap from a fresh college graduate into your first in that field?
So my senior year of a degree in healthcare administration, you have to do an internship. So I went to something called Volunteer Johnson City because I had no idea what that would open up. So I did a lot of volunteer jobs with the First Tennessee Development District. I ran the hotline for if you drank too much, I would be your ride home, to being a volunteer on Saturdays in a nursing home. So I would go and do activities on Saturday morning, and then Saturday night I'd go and cheer a ball game. But because of that, I thought, well, nursing homes would be, maybe that's where I do my internship. My grandmother, my dad's mom at the time, was in a retirement community, a private pay retirement community in Kingsport that had a nursing home attached. So like, why don't you apply there, Janet, for your internship? So I ended up interning at a nursing home for the summer and loved it. I knew nothing about what it would take. And back then, you had to have license to be a nursing home administrator. You could only set for the exam. It was a paper exam 4 times a year. He'd have to come to, and the place in Tennessee was McKendree in Nashville.
Okay.
And so my mentor for this internship kind of opened those doors. So I'm going down a path a little bit blindly, not knowing, mm-hmm. but knowing this is at least something. This is a portable credential. Mm-hmm. I have a degree in healthcare administration. I was the youngest and the first to take the path that there was a way to get set for your nursing home exam that didn't require a preceptor, an administrator in training program, because no one before had set for the exam with the actual degree in healthcare administration. Wow. So at 23 years old, I am setting for an exam to be a nursing home administrator for the state of Tennessee.
Are you nervous sitting there, or are you...
Scared to death.
Scared to death. But was there not part of you, though, because I've seen you work, and you yes. have this, when you are setting ablaze a new path, you might be scared, but there's always a level of confidence in you that it's going to work out. Is that kind of what carried you through that credential there?
I was going to be that person that overprepared.
Yeah.
So I was nervous.
Yes.
But this is back in the days of cassette tapes.
Okay.
And you could get a manual, a paperback manual. Mm-hmm. I'm really dating myself. So I read the questions, the answers to help me prepare for my exam. Mm-hmm. So I'd listen to that over and over and over again. I'd go to sleep listening to it. My drive from Upper East Tennessee, Jonesboro, to Nashville, I listened to that tape the whole entire way coming to Nashville. So I knew that I was going to be prepared for this test. There was no way that I was not going to pass this test. So I passed the test with flying colors. My parents are like, now what? I'm like, I don't know. But I
had the credential.
I started looking for nursing home administrator positions and interviewing everywhere and really starting to learn as I interviewed about the potential. So at 23, almost 24, but at 23 years old, I interviewed for a position in Limestone, Tennessee, and I did not get that position. Mm-hmm. But shortly thereafter, the person that was being replaced as a lady at the time, Linda Jennings, Linda Estes now, who became my lifetime friend and mentor, was looking for an administrator at a nursing home in Jonesboro, Tennessee. The place where she left, they said, I think we made a mistake. We should have hired Janet Snodgrass, and we didn't. You may want to interview her. Wow. She interviewed me for that job at Four Oaks. I landed a job as an administrator with almost 100 employees, 85 patients at the age of 23 years old.
Wow. And it's such... I can only imagine, because looking at me at 23, entering such a professional field, I think I would have been so scared. But looking back on that career, looking back on healthcare administration, all of the things you've done since, as the leader of Ayers Foundation Trust, the volunteer boards that you've been, what of that are you most proud of to start there in that professional at 23? A professional way before most of us even think about a professional career. You've been doing this. What are the things along the way that you've been most proud of that jump-started at that role?
The thing that has carried me all the way through to right now today is relationships matter. Do not be afraid to ask questions and lean in and learn. Don't go in there thinking you know everything or that you know anything. Go in there with a spirit of, I want to learn everything. And then when you're learning it and you're starting to master it, then you start saying, now how can we do it better? And I feel like at 23 I was doing that. At 33 I was doing that. When Jim and I were married and I stepped in as president of the trust, it was the same thing that I did at 23. I didn't know anything about it, and I wanted to learn, to lean in and to learn. And then once I started learning, now what can we do to make us better? And I think that will continue. I hope when I take my last breath, I'm still leaning in and trying to learn. You know, at 50 years old, my college roommate and best friend and I decided, you know, most girls' trips, you aren't sitting by the pool saying, you know what, I think it'd be really fun to get our master's degree. But that's what we did. So yes. Even at 50, mm-hmm. wanting to do better, learn more. And I think that's what education is. That 23 when I was going through college and now, and I think that's the spirit of what we do at the foundation is, gosh, never stop learning.
Mm-hmm. Always be curious. That always. Curiosity at 23, it's having that opportunity at 23 that you earned through the curiosity of a healthcare administration degree, the curiosity of getting this credential, seeing the satisfaction of being able to be on the cusp of that. I mean, you see it today. I've worked with you now. I'm in year nine of my time with the Ayers Foundation, and that was always impressive because we've entered new fields as Ayers Foundation, and we never do it unless we're confident enough that we've been curious long enough, that we've asked the questions, that we've said, is this worth our time? Is this worth our space? You know, do we want to hedge our bets on this? So it's been such a fun ride to see us do some of that. And seeing the Ayers Scholars Program go from when I started, it was in four high schools. You know, started in one high school in 1999. You join in, you expand it to, I think was it at two when you came on, or was it three?
It was two when
it was
I came
two
on
when
board.
You came on. Mm-hmm. We're now in these like three connecting counties. We bring Unicoi County on later on. And then now to see so many high schools, so many counties, to take this thing statewide, what are some of just some of those results of this curiosity that you're proud of within the Scholars Program? Like, what are you pumped to see when we talk at the end of the year of some of the impacts that are being made?
I just love the spirit of the group, and I can't believe, Jesse, it's been 9 years, and we have changed so much mm-hmm. in so many good ways. Mm-hmm. I think we have something that we know is transforming lives. And the question that we always, to not lose the culture of one student at a time, but to always keep saying, why not? And then we push hard on the why not, mm-hmm. because if it takes us off focus, takes us off mission, we don't go there. As long as we stay true to our core and we really try to build up how we can serve students and serve them well, it has allowed us to not only expand, but to go deeper and deeper. And I think it's because we've been willing to be a culture of not being stale. And the more we learn, the more we want to do. And to resist the temptation to go wide without going.
Yes.
And I think sometimes that's what happens with a lot of organizations. They have something really good and they find that it's scalable. So you go really wide, but you don't go deep. We're managing to do both. It makes it take a little longer, but wow, mm-hmm. the results that you all are getting mm-hmm. are undeniably game-changing for the individual and for the communities we serve.
Yeah, because the pace that we've gone, you brought up one of our, I would almost say like one of our core values, which is one student at a time. But with the pace that we've gone, we've really allowed ourselves to go by our other core value, which is all means all. You know, all students means all students. So every student that comes through a school that we serve, we're going to help them in some way. And it's been also really refreshing to hear kind of some of the backstory of where you get your curiosity, because you inspired that culture too of all means all when it comes to us as a team tackling things. You know, it's all hands on deck at all times if needed. You know, like this culture that you started when I came on 9 years ago, it was already there. It was this, we're going to help each other out in this. We're not silos. And even as we spread out to more counties, you've been able to keep that going and say, like, I know this county is 2 hours away from some of our other counties, but we're going to make the effort to be there. Like, we're going to show up to some of these college signing days. We're going to send leadership to make sure they're getting in the weeds with these people as well. And so you're right. It's that scale with the time that allows those results to really come through. Looking at the size and the scale, it doesn't start expanding until you have the model, you know, until we have what we know works in these small counties that we start in. So let's just dive just a moment into the unique college access model that we have. You know, what sets it apart from these other programs that we see across the nation and even in the state?
I learned this when I was in college from my gymnastics coach. And those of y'all been with me a long time have heard this analogy. But I really do think that's why on paper sometimes it looks simple and it's not. My gymnastics coach used to tell me, because I did dance and I did gymnastics even before I went to college. He was my coach in high school. He's like, Janet, do you want to do acrobatics, which is the art of taking something simple and making it look hard? Or do you want to take the art of gymnastics, which is something hard done well, look simple and flawless? Well, of course I wanted to do gymnastics.
Of course. I need the challenge.
Yes. Our team does gymnastics. So on the surface, I think what happens is a lot of duplicate programs are doing acrobatics. They're taking the surface and spreading it out. We're doing something hard and making it look easy. And that model, to begin with, we kept thinking, gosh, do we even have a model? We almost were discounting what we're doing by saying, but gosh, y'all, this is just common sense.
We're just making it work.
Yes. But the hard part is there's no shortcut. The reason that this model works, and we have been able to formalize it through the years, what this expansion has allowed us to do is to really start getting our arms around what is our model.
That's right.
And our model is the hard work of relationships and the face-to-face work and the diligence of meeting the students where they are. And so many times, and I hate to keep using analogies, but this does take me back to when I was a child, when I was seven. And my grandmother would make beautiful quilts, and I wanted to make my mom a quilt because I have the best mom in the world. And I started sewing that quilt, and oh my gosh, I got so tired of sewing that quilt. So then I took my tiny tot stapler, and I stapled some of those patches together. And then I ran out of staples, and I didn't want to go through the effort of having to replace the staples in my tiny tot stapler. So I taped the rest of that quilt together. I think some of these programs are trying to, it gets hard.
Yeah.
These relationships get messy. It's hard with these students. So we're quilting along, and we start stapling, and we start taping. We're still quilting in our program.
That's right.
Even if it gets hard, every patch, every hard relationship, everything that our students are going through, these counselors are leaning in.
Mm-hmm.
We're giving them the toolbox for whatever they present. I don't expect anybody to be an expert in everything. I just expect them to be able to bring the toolkit to whatever that student needs. And that really is an easier way of saying what we're putting the nuts and bolts around our model.
Yeah, it reminds the counselors to be curious and ask why not.
Yes.
You know, as we look at these things, at these barriers, you know, we love to say barrier remover.
Yes.
And because it's broad enough to really try to get around what we're trying to do in these role places that don't have a dedicated person for every role. Sometimes we're connecting kids. We're being things like, you know, their coach, you know, a guide through the college process, an emotional supporter, but also a technical supporter.
Absolutely.
As everything gets more wireless and everything gets more spread out, it's like there's so many people that we need them to be that we don't expect our counselors to be that person, but we want them to ask, who is that person? Can I form that relationship? Can I get these students connected? And it's just, oh, it's
you're
so
their advocate. You are the ones that, if they're food insecure, you're putting them to the right place. If they're undocumented, you're getting them to the right place. If they're homeless, you're getting them to the right place.
Right. They're not doing anything. I used to tell my students, I worked in schools for 7 years before I took an operations role. And I was like, you know, a student will not at all think about the fall semester of college if they don't know where they're sleeping in the summer.
Absolutely.
It can't happen. You know, there's
you got it early on, Jesse.
Well, there's a hierarchy of needs that like has to be answered. Are there any success stories from the Air Scholars Program that just stand out to you? Any that you've heard throughout the year? Because I know we talk so much to try to bring them to you to say this is what's happening.
The reason that's so hard is because every single student has a story.
That's right.
And not one is more dynamic than the other because they're so different. But, you know, there's things that stand out to me through the years are, you know, it's probably easier present mind because I just came from a Unicoi County signing day.
Mm-hmm.
We have a student getting ready to graduate from Yale that's coming back from Tennessee who took his hometown values but is bringing them back. And I think that's important to note that rural student is certainly qualified to go to and through an Ivy League school without being changed.
Mm-hmm.
Well-educated, but probably did some educating of his own while he was there. First generation could have never had that opportunity without that barrier remover. But in that same county, somebody that was the caregiver to my daughter who would pick her up after school and bring her to me to the nursing home or whatever I needed to do, now has a son who I've seen from birth past graduation. He was in one of those welding programs that we had to be a barrier remover in Unicoi County, create a special welding program. He has gone through that program and has such a great job. He's getting ready to get married, and he is paying cash for his home. I mean, what opposite end of the spectrum, but it tells the story of what's happening from Upper East Tennessee to West Tennessee, and there's so many stories in between. For me, what that says is one isn't more important than the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's meeting that student. It's removing barriers, whether it's creating a special program or helping pay and take that family up there to interview for that job at Yale and helping them try to find housing now in Nashville to come back with that degree and next steps before law school. I think there's 20,000 stories like those two. Those just happen to be ones that are fresh in mind because it was last Friday.
But you know what's funny about that, and I know you don't like a good compliment for yourself, but it goes back to those consistent values that your family brought you up in, which is not keeping it a secret. You know, the woman that was a caregiver to your daughter, not keeping the secret, and, you know, now her son is benefiting from that, taking that credential and bringing a whole new generation of wealth and potential and opportunity. It's just, I think those are some of my favorite stories are the students that I helped at Lexington that didn't know there were any options. You know, you talk about when you saw architect, lawyer, teacher, nurse. Those are the jobs we think of first. And that's because that's what we've talked about for college. And so just being able to expose students through our scholars program and say, all of these credentials, all these job possibilities. And then there's also opportunities in your county. Like if you wanted to be here, these are high-paying jobs. A short credential, short education, four-year education, something along those lines can help you be here. Because that's something, I'll never forget a student that talked to me one day and said, I would love to go into marine biology. And I was like, oh, that's fantastic. Here are some schools. Here's some this. We're talking about them. And then it finally, the communication stopped abruptly when the student realized she couldn't live here and do that. And her dedication to her town, she said, oh, no, I don't want to leave here. I love it here. And she's a successful student. She graduated with a four-year degree. She's teaching. But we see that in our work now. And that inspired kind of this, our latest venture with Come Home Tennessee, trying to get things started here. When did you first notice that was an issue, jobs here?
It's my Perry County story. What became very poignant to me is probably about 5 or 6 years ago. Perry County is one of our schools, one of our five original schools that was always consistently in the top five and lots of times was the number one college-going county in the state of Tennessee, even above Williamson County, which is the wealthiest county. And Perry County is one of the poorest counties. But if you dug in just a little bit deeper, and about that time, and I could probably date it because when the census came out, and the census showed Perry County in the lowest quartile of college-educated citizenry. So if you were to ask Economic Development Board or anybody from Perry County, they would say, but we just don't have the workforce. And there was that aha moment. But yes, you do. You're just exporting them out. And the wildly successful results that you all are delivering, one student at a time, about getting them two and three post-secondary, we really hadn't just said, oh, wow, we have been so successful, we're exporting our best and our brightest.
That's right.
So at that moment, we realized there's another step to what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're meeting these students one student at a time, and it's great, even if they move off somewhere, we've benefited that student's lives forever. But we love these rural communities.
And they love them too.
And they do too. And we needed to figure out now how do we get them to come back.
Which has been my favorite part of working here is when we discover that next step. Because even as we call it college access was step one. You know, mm-hmm. showing them, exposing them to college, and getting them to college was just, I mean, a baby step compared to what we've had to do since, which is focus on retention. You know, that became the goal. Well, we need to retain them. They need to stay in school. What barriers can we help remove from freshman to sophomore year, sophomore to junior? And then it became two and through. We need to get them to graduate. And so we want to see those graduation rates. We want to start studying. Like, where are we losing them at? What's happening? Is it just life happening? Because life does happen, and sometimes there are breaks. But what can we do to help them? This feels like, I don't want to quote sci-fi, this feels like a final frontier. This feels like, for our scope, the ultimate success is helping them be here, be in these towns that have loved them, that we know we love, they know they love, and they can go experience whatever's out there, and they can stay in those large towns because they'll still carry that hometown spirit with them. As we get to that area, is that something you said you first kind of saw it 5 or 6 years ago? Tell me the thought process between 5 and 6 years ago and now where you thought, we're actually going to jump into this. We're actually going to do something.
It became just like data became mm-hmm. our mantra, this became ours because data, we really leaned into the data piece that, you know, we want it to be verified independently. The numbers are getting so good. When we had that aha moment with Perry County, that became our narrative. That became our go-to of, we can't rest till we figure out what this looks like. Mm-hmm. And it was conversations we were having cross-country, wherever platform we were at. We really started to say, we can be the convener of this conversation because no one else is doing to and through like we're doing. And you have to have the to and through in order to bring back. It's hard to bring back when you're talking about you don't have a workforce that's educated or, you know, that's the barrier to remove mm-hmm. for these communities. There was no one else doing it better than you all were doing. And so we really started carrying that message. Started it with the Haslam administration, but then you have a change of administration and Governor Bill Lee ran on that platform, really visited deeply these rural communities, had a connection with it. There was something that magical that happened that we had been talking about for several years because we expanded under the Lee administration, but it was really never about expanding college access or the to and through. That's where we had the success metrics. But that light in his eyes and the light in the room of everybody that we were talking when we said, the first step of this, we have. We've nailed. We know how to do it now. But we need to have to figure out how to get them back.
We need help learning and yes. staying curious and getting that.
Yes.
You know, because this is not just economic development.
No, it is not just economic development.
It's a piece. It's part of it. But it's so much more complicated and deeper than that. Because that's surface level. That's leaving out half of the conversation in Come-Home, Tennessee, if we just classified it as only economic development.
Absolutely.
And so seeing this space grow, continue to grow, and continue to refine, it's one of the most exciting things as we work to scale that first piece to help figure out that second piece. I know you're excited like I am.
I am just like everything else. We will be intellectually curious. We will lean in. We'll be willing to ask those hard questions, and we won't be afraid of what we find in the data and the research that goes behind it. But we crack the code on to and through with these rural students. I bet this group of very creative, lean into it people that we have at the Ayers Foundation Trust, we're going to crack this code too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to take it back to that 23-year-old fresh executive. As we wind down, I'd love to just hear just a couple of your insights because you were a healthcare administrator, and we won't name years of when that college graduation happened.
That's okay. I own how old I am.
But I'd love to hear some of your experiences as a female leader and as a young female leader
yes.
at 23, and what can still be in the year of our Lord 2024, traditionally male dominated boardrooms and leadership positions. You know, what are some of your insights into those experiences and how you learn from them?
You can imagine being 23 and looking 12 in the 1980s, what that must have felt and looked like. And I'd like to say in 2024 that it was significantly different. It might be slightly different, but not significantly.
We can still relate to it too much?
Unfortunately, yes. My takeaways have been, then and still now, I talk about relationships, and it was about relationships. I was underestimated. Sometimes the things that frustrate us the most can become your superpower. So being underestimated as a 23-year-old in that space, just like I did to prepare for my exam, I made sure that I was very prepared and armed with facts, no different than we do as an organization and be armed with facts and data. Be prepared, be over-prepared, because you're going to be underestimated. But over time, and really a short amount of time, amazingly, can I tell you that even now that I don't get underestimated sometimes, I would be lying if I didn't say that happened. But what I can say is after just a few minutes, because you're prepared and you know your data and you know your facts, at some point in that process, your gender and your age fade to the background, and then you get down to the business of business. It served me well at 23. It served me well at 53, and it serves me well at 60. If you are prepared and you know your facts, I'm not going to tell you it's easy, but it will get you where you need to be. And the attention and the respect that you need, whether you're at the head of an organization or sitting in that boardroom. Because after you graduate, I know that grades and all those things matter, But what people are really looking for is results. Mm-hmm. And I had the facts and the results to back me up. And that carried a lot of weight.
I think it is really cool, especially to see the same way that we expose high school students to career opportunities. It, you know, simply exposing young girls to see women as leaders. You know, I'm a father of a daughter. She is 8 years old. And it was really cool when it clicked in her mind that you are our president and that you're a girl. And she said, oh, Miss Janet, she's your boss is a girl? I said, yes, that's right. I was like, and she has done so much for our foundation. We have, you know, broke all this ground. We're doing such good things. I was like, and it started our president. You know, she kind of leads that vision. And so just planting that idea early now is I hope, the advantage we have of 2024 versus the 80s, which is to be able to at least see
absolutely
that those things.
Because there weren't many that I saw anywhere. And as a side note, I know your daughter is a gymnast. So you tell her to keep doing those hard things and make them look easy. She will change the world.
She really enjoys that part too. And those things that do, I mean, they look hard to me. So God bless her for giving that effort.
You know, living her life upside down.
That's right. And speaking of that, you know, speaking of girls my daughter's age and even our high school seniors and our college students, you know, what advice would you give to those young women aspiring to leadership roles, especially in areas that you've kind of, I mean, let's say, dominated, like education and healthcare? What's some advice you'd give to those aspiring young women, the next Janet Ayers?
The next Janet Ayers. My grandmother, he was really the original pioneer, both of them really. There were a few things that they taught me, but you have to earn trust. And it's something I even taught my very young granddaughters. Words and actions matter. Make sure your words and actions match. Walk the walk, talk the talk, always. And treat people with dignity. Now, I can give you a direct quote from my grandmother, because remember, I was going into the nursing home business. She was in a retirement community on the independent living side. But she said, Janet, whatever you do, don't put a birthday hat on them and make them play bingo. I'm like, my grandmother really loved bingo. But what she was trying to tell me was, treat everybody with dignity and that's respect. Right. And I never, ever lost that. And from a very practical side point, she said, Janet, everything's better by letter. Document everything. Make sure that you are keeping up with what you do. Back things up with facts. Tell the story, but back everything with facts.
Keep the notes.
Keep the notes.
Ms. Janet, my friend, it is always lovely to catch up with you. I think we should just make this a series. That way we can make an excuse to hang out again.
I love hanging out with you, Jesse. Always fun to hang out with you.
Well, I've certainly appreciated you sitting down with me at our Ayers Audio Visual Studio. We are in Parsons. Like, this is one of the small town things that's happening.
And it's really cool.
I mean, this is available as we dive into those new fields and entrepreneur centers that we're taking the forefront on, introducing to small towns. So it's really exciting to be here with you.
There's a lot to be said for these small towns.
That's right. That's right. Well, until next time, my friend, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you for tuning into 10 Talks. 10 Talks is recorded in the Ayers Audiovisual Studio located in the Ayers Entrepreneur Center in Parsons, Tennessee. You can find the Ayers Entrepreneur Center on Facebook, and you can also find out more about Ayers Foundation Trust at ayersfoundationtrust.org and facebook.com/AyersFSP.